Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Elizabeth Shackelford, a senior U.S. diplomat, resigned over the weekend, saying that President Trump and Secretary of State Tillerson had shown what she described as stinging disrespect for the Foreign Service. Her letter was released to the press and has become the most public rebuke of the U.S. foreign policy leadership to date. Next, we talk about the future of Iraq. Iraq declared today that Daesh, or ISIS, has officially been defeated. In this segment, we'll discuss what's next, in particular the role that the U.S. will play from this point forward. Then, days after Trump announced that the United States would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, we'll discuss whether the move could trigger a new level of resistance and struggle by the Palestinians. And then, two new polls released this morning show Alabama Democratic Senate nominee Doug Jones and Republican nominee Roy Moore exchanging leads before tomorrow's special election. Will Jones pull off a win in the heavily Republican state, or will Moore extend his extremist influence all the way to Washington? And finally, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has asked his country's Congress to extend martial law in the southern state of Mindanao for a year in order to allow for what he calls the total eradication of Muslim extremists and communists. A key tenet of the request is that all media would be banned from Mindanao. That's all starting now on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to the continuing crisis in the State Department. Elizabeth Shackelford, a senior U.S. diplomat, resigned over the weekend, saying that President Trump and Secretary of State Tillerson had shown what she called stinging disrespect for the Foreign Service. Her letter was released to the press and has become the most public rebuke of the U.S. foreign policy leadership to date during the Trump administration. We're joined from Athens, Greece, by Brady Kiesling. He's a former senior U.S. diplomat who resigned from the Foreign Service in 2002 in protest of the Iraq War. Brady, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you.
Brady, you left the State Department for similar reasons. You disagreed with policy and you put your money where your mouth was. You think we're going to be seeing more and more people resigning from the Foreign Service because of what we're seeing now under Secretary of State Tillerson?
When I resigned just 2 weeks before the Iraq War began, I was the first of three U.S. diplomats to leave. We agonized over whether it was a good thing for Moore to leave or not. The bottom line is that the United States has a desperate need to keep in being a strong professional foreign service. That said, every gesture of resignation, we have to make the most of it if we can, you know, put forward a message, you've got to save the system, you've got to save America's national image, you've got to save U.S. national interests from the idiots in Washington.
And you have to do it from the inside, don't you? You know, the State Department, the Foreign Service is so important in that it's an expression of America's soft power. I think most Americans don't understand just how influential State Department Foreign Service officers are. And when we have a State Department that's eviscerated, we have a Foreign Service where positions are not being filled, especially at the very, very top, it makes us a weaker country, does it not?
It's really dangerous not to have the best and brightest and most idealistic young Americans looking at diplomacy as a viable career choice. The State Department, the Foreign Service, should look like not the United States, but the way the United States wants to look. That is, bright, culturally sensitive people, hard-nosed, realistic, but very sophisticated in how foreigners think, going out and talking to foreigners, proving that we understand them, that we respect them, that we understand how their interests and our interests really converge, and this is how you're going to do it. But you cannot do that except by sending out really bright, really impressive people with a message of positive U.S. values. And right now we have a president who's exuding the worst in American exceptionalism and asking diplomats to faithfully pass on that message, and you understand why people are leaving.
Brady, there are currently 13 assistant secretaries of state positions that are vacant. But then President Trump, when asked about it, said that we don't need to fill those positions because he's in charge and he's dictating the policy. Explain to our listeners why that just simply doesn't work.
The major battles in foreign policy are always domestic political battles. It turns out that the United States doesn't have one national interest. It has 300 million national interests because every individual has a different set of things they need protected. And the interagency process exists to take the values and the interests of the Commerce Department, the Pentagon, the Internal Revenue Service, everyone, and balance them. And it's the job of the State Department to explain how all of those interests can be sold to foreigners in a way that makes sense. And if you do not have all of the components of the interagency process, your policy will be garbage. And right now, we do not have senior representatives who know the outside world in the interagency process explaining why, sorry, Pentagon, you cannot do that because it'll cost the United States too much. You can do this instead, which is almost as good. But if you do not have an assistant secretary in the room when they've got three assistant secretaries in the room, you're not going to be listened to.
You know, there's another position at the State Department that I think most Americans are not aware of, and that's the position of career ambassador. When Donald Trump became president, there were six career ambassadors at the State Department. And these are men who have been ambassador to, you know, as many as a half a dozen different countries, the biggest and most important countries in the world. Well, now here we are a year into the Trump presidency, and there are two career ambassadors. Again, President Trump was asked about this less than a week ago, and he said that that the numbers are deceiving, that we've only gone from six to two. Yes, it's a large percentage drop, but not in terms of numbers, and it doesn't really matter. Does it matter that we're losing this kind of expertise?
The people who survive the bureaucratic process to become career ambassadors are impressive people, really smart, really balanced, able to speak to foreigners, able to impress the United States Senate, able to get the message across where it needs to be gotten across. They have tremendous experience and they are an asset we should not be letting leave lightly. And I mean, it's true of the whole most senior ranks of the State Department. Yes, you don't want people hanging around forever, but you need a steady process of promotion. But right now, we don't have promotions. We are freezing the promotions at all levels, trying to persuade the State Department that they should all leave peacefully so we can fill their ranks with Trump voters, I guess. I can't see anything else that makes sense.
We're talking with Brady Keesling. He resigned as a matter of principle a few weeks before the March 19, 2003 shock and awe invasion launched by the Bush administration, one of three State Department officials. Brady, we've had Ann Wright on this show a couple times. She was one of the others who resigned in protest. When you think about the U.S. as a global power, or John and I were talking about this before the show, you know, the British and the French Empire sort of disappeared within about 5 years around World War II. At the time of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the governments of Eastern and Central Europe that were aligned with the Soviet Union, that happened very quickly. In other words, things can happen very dynamically and very, very quickly. At the end of World War II, the United States had 6% of the world's population, but 50% of the world's economic production. Its cities were not laying in ruin. It had a very strong military. It set up military bases around the world. It also had this diplomatic corps that was able to exercise what John called soft power, or sometimes not so soft. In other words, it was a multifaceted a capacity by the United States that took the place of the British Empire as the dominant power in the world. When you look at the big picture since you've resigned, how do you see America's global status?
The smartest thing the United States did after World War II was use the legitimacy we had gained as the crucial power in that struggle to build a new international order based on the United Nations, based on the idea that international law would cover everybody, including us. And by being willing to subordinate ourselves, at least in little things, to international law, to treaties, we forced the rest of the world to go along with that. And we had a period of unbroken peace and development, at least, you know, in the core of Western Europe and the United States. We now have an administration that's taking that whole international order apart, saying we do not need treaties because they tie our hands. We do not need international law because international law is for weak states. We are a strong state. But then you look at the balance of power. We are not strong economically in the way we were after World War II. We are part of a very complicated international system. If we screw up the system, we will find ourselves much poorer and in much greater danger than we were with the old international order, where we sat at the top as a benevolent superpower.
That was the voice of Brady Keesling. Brady is a former senior U.S. diplomat who resigned in 2003 in protest of the Iraq War. He joined us from Athens, Greece. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
In this segment, we talk about the future of Iraq. Iraq declared today that Daesh, the so-called Islamic State, has officially been defeated. In this segment, we will discuss what's next, in particular, the role that the United States will play or try to play from this point forward. We're joined from London by Catherine Chakdam. She is an independent journalist and the author of the book, A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Welcome back, Catherine.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for joining. Daesh is officially defeated, according to the Iraqi government. On that basis, one might think that it was time for the United States to leave once again from Iraq. How do you think the U.S. government, the Pentagon, views it, and what will they try to do, and what will be the reaction inside of Iraq?
Well, there's two possibilities. I mean, either the U.S., you know, will try to find a way to accompany, you know, the Iraqi military and the Iraqi government in ensuring that Daesh does not come back. Because, you know, when the government came out today and said that, you know, Daesh had been defeated, yes, but we have to remain quite realistic as to, you know, now this, the ideology is not dead. And so it is expected that, you know, certain pockets would remain and that we might see, you know, militants go back to some kind of, a, you know, guerrilla type war situation where they're going to continue to target civilians and try to stage a return. So I think that in that way, the U.S. might argue that it needs to accompany and, you know, the Iraqi government and ensure that Daesh does not come back, or that something else doesn't actually use, you know, whatever vacuum has been created to actually even create some kind of a Daesh 2.0. So I could see this. Or they would, you know, quite simply architect and engineer a new enemy, and argue that they have to absolutely stay to ensure that that enemy is contained. And I would imagine that Iran would serve, you know, as a perfect culprit when it comes to inventing a new enemy.
Catherine, I have to stop you right there because I'm looking at the press, today's press, and countries all over the region, Turkey, Jordan, all over the Gulf, are congratulating the Iraqi government on its defeat of ISIS or Daesh. But then there's a statement by the American ambassador, a statement yesterday, saying that the U.S. is now looking to counter Iran in post-war Iraq, that the fight is not with ISIS anymore. The fight is going to be with Iran. Brian and I were talking a moment ago off the air about exactly this issue, that the United States is always looking for a reason to remain in a country after the threat has gone away. Do you think that's what we're seeing here? Are we looking at a permanent U.S. presence in Iraq?
Absolutely. I mean, it's quite clear now. I mean, for decades, the U.S. has looked for excuses and, you know, or try to justify its presence in the Middle East by either creating an enemy or even coming up with fallacies. You know, I mean, we have to remember the weapons of mass destruction and all the rest, you know, that came after it. But, you know, when it comes to Iran, if you actually look, you know, at the region as a whole, not just Iraq, you will know that everything that has been done so far, you know, if you look at Kurdistan, if you look at, you know, the Hariri situation in Lebanon, if you look even at Yemen and, you know, the killing of former President Ali Abdullah Saleh, you can see that everything has been architected to, you know, ignite tensions and crisis in the Middle East to somehow justify, you know, U.S. military interventionism because Daesh is essentially dead in both Syria and Iraq. So what is it that the U.S. is to do but to ensure that, you know, crises are, number one, created, and number two, that someone is being blamed for it? And of course, every time that something has happened, Iran, for some reason, has always landed in those sentences. So when we have a crisis in Lebanon, Iran is to blame. When we have a crisis in Yemen, Iran is to blame. When we have a crisis in Iraq, that actually is not a crisis, but rather a victory, Iran is to blame. If you listen to the language coming out of Saudi Arabia, which we must listen to very carefully because the Saudi are echoing whatever it is that the U.S. wants us to say, they are arguing now that the Arab and the Middle East in general should be more wary of Iran than Israel, that the real threat is not Israel, is not the fact that, you know, millions of people stand to be disappeared under Zionism, but rather the threat of Iran. We're not quite sure why and how, but Iran has been declared, you know, the number one enemy, you know, right now in the Middle East, because, of course, we need to have an enemy in the Middle East. It doesn't matter if it stands to reason. It doesn't matter if it's logical or even, you know, somehow anchored in reality. As long as we have an enemy, then Washington is happy. You know, Iran has always been, you know, labeled the grand enemy that America had to have for decades now, just because, you know, back in 1979, Iranians decided that they wanted to actually be the master of their own political fate and use and exploit their own natural resources as opposed to, you know, the British Empire doing it for them and on their behalf and actually reap the benefits of it. There's an irony there that, you know, because Daesh did not hold to its potential as far as America was concerned in terms of, you know, justifying decades of, you know, of presence and, you know, weapon sales and whatnot, siphoning of natural resources, then that Iran is suddenly becoming, you know, this great big button that everyone's, you know, keeps poking at, hoping to generate a conflict. It's interesting because whenever there's been a crisis so far in the Middle East over the past few months, it was Iran that actually diffused it. If you look at, you know, the Kurdistan crisis, Iran managed to diffuse it. If you look at Lebanon, Iran helped diffuse it. If you look at, you know, Syria, Iraq again with Daesh. If you look at Yemen, Iran is staying the hell away from Yemen because it understands that whatever it's going to do or say will be misinterpreted and misunderstood anyway, and used against, you know, not only the many people, but Iranians as well. So I just find interesting how Washington is insisting on actually revealing its hand by, you know, playing, you know, the perpetual belligerent power, you know, over and over again. I mean, come on, by now we know the drill.
Okay, we're also joined now by Mojtaba Masood. We're talking to him from London. He's a filmmaker. His films include Islamophobia, Cause and Effect, and ISIS, Islamic Extremism, ? Welcome, Mojtaba.
Hi, Tony.
Thank you. We're talking in our last few minutes about the what the U.S. Will do in Iraq now that Iraq has declared, the Iraqi government has declared that ISIS is defeated. The question before us is, will the United States actually now leave Iraq, or is it going to have, using perhaps Iran as a pretext, an excuse to stay on? What's your opinion on that?
I think the United States will be in it for the long run. Even the bases seem to be bases that will be equipped and will include many of the U.S. soldiers, the U.S. advisors, mainly because of the, as you mentioned, Iranian influence and the importance of having a foothold in Iraq, especially with the current government. I mean, one of the main issues that we looked at in terms of the Kurdish issue, the United States refused to neglect the central government in that conflict, and instead actually standing with central government in Baghdad. So most likely they will continue in Iraq in it for the long run, mainly because of the geopolitical issues in that region, including Iran, including the Syria, and many other potential conflicts that could take place.
And what about Iran's influence in Iraq? How do you see it?
Well, the Iranian influence is mainly to do with on two fronts, mainly on the level in terms of the PMUs. The paramilitary units are some of them obviously backed by the government in Iran, and they're in a situation right now where they were the important factor in ensuring Baghdad doesn't fall, and many of the politicians admitted that. In Iraq and in other regions. Now that the PMU have gained enough power where they're actual sizable to the army, they're not going to disband, and therefore the influence from Iran is likely to stay. The PMUs right now, I think, in terms of popularity, exceed their popularity compared to the Iraqi army and central government, and therefore ultimately, some of these groups are backed by Iran, and therefore Iran will have a say in Iraq, just as much as it does in Syria and in Lebanon with Hezbollah. It's almost created this sort of unit in Iraq.
Mujtaba, this is John Kiriakou. I wanted to ask you about President Trump's decision to move the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. How is this going to change the way the United States is able to influence governments, people, events in Iraq? Will it have any impact on Iraq?
Well, we've seen a number of leaders in Iraq, Muqtada al-Sadr. I don't know if you've been paying attention to what he's been saying. He's been quite vocal.
Yes, he has.
Which is surprising, actually, because Muqtada al-Sadr has been kind of more towards than talking about nationalism in Iraq, uniting Sunnis and Shias, and not really mentioning issues, in fact, criticizing Iran in one or two instances, and not really mentioning Palestine recently. But because of the event that took place with Donald Trump, that seemed to make him raise some sort of issue on Palestine. And then you have also the Asa'ab al-Haq leader, Qais al-Khazali, who is one of the PMU, basically they're a group in the PMUs, and he was actually seen near the Palestinian the border close to Israel, and also signaling that that we oppose what's been done in Palestine and in terms of the Jerusalem being the capital of Israel. And that's a very important factor in terms of domestic issues. Domestic issues, these leaders will never really mention Palestine, never really looked at the outward issues that Iran mostly talks about. And since we see that now they're raising up issues that looks like Hamas and Hezbollah and this Assad's government would raise up. Now that they're also bringing up these issues to the forefront, really shows the importance of to the Arab world, in particular now Iraq. Iraq was a country that was so concerned with its own issues. Palestine was never something that they raised, but now that they've managed to defeat IS, we see groups like PMUs, leaders of PMUs, bringing this issue up.
Well, let's go back to Catherine Shakhtam. We have about 2.5 minutes, Catherine, so I want to ask you and then get back to Mujtaba. What we're reading here in the press is that some of the spokespeople for the PMU, the Popular Mobilization Units, or also known in vernacular here in the media as the Shiite militias in Iraq, who have done a big bulk of the fighting in Mosul and elsewhere against Daesh, they say the quotes in the media are Americans are now legitimate targets in Iraq by the PMUs, given the decision by the Trump administration to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Same question to you, Catherine. Will this have a profound or, if not profound, some impact on U.S. standing or status inside of Iraq?
Yes, of course. I mean, as far as the people are concerned, of course, it's going to affect the standing of the U.S. I mean, they're not well-loved anyway, so it's not going to endear them to the people. When it comes to the government, the Iraqi government, I think, will be a bit more careful into how it's dealing with the U.S. But let's be honest here. I mean, it's necessary for Iraq to deal with Washington because, first of all, it's part of the international community. And number two, for financial reason, geopolitical reason, it needs, to remain a partner of the U.S. Now, how this partnership is going to be formulated will be actually interesting because I think that Baghdad now has enough standing and anchoring, within its own sovereignty to actually change how things are being done and the discussion and the way that the discussion is actually being, again, formulated when it comes to foreign policy and the role that the US will play moving forward in Iraq. So it's going to be very different. Now, as far as Palestine is concerned, I think it's, I don't think the changes would not be made, I would say, on state level. I think that the people, however, will dictate the tone as to how their state representative will react to the news. And I think that reaction will come. I don't think we have heard the last of it.
All right. Moshtaba, we have 15 seconds left. Go ahead. Your final words.
I think right now we're starting to see the Iraqi model. We've got a Saudi model, an Iranian model in the region, and now slowly the emergence of an Iraqi model, which will side more with Iran.
Very interesting. Okay, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from London by Moshtaba Masood. He's an Iraqi journalist and a filmmaker whose films include Islamophobia, Cause and Effect, and ISIS, Islamic Extremism, and also from London by Catherine Shakdam. She is an independent journalist and the author of the book, A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Days after President Trump announced that the United States would recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, we will discuss whether the move could trigger a new level of resistance and struggle by the Palestinian people. We're joined from Albuquerque by Satya Vatti. She's an organizer with the Answer Coalition. Satya, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Brian and John.
Satya, here in the studio, Brian and I were saying that that this announcement of the recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel has done something that no one else has ever been able to do, and that is to unite Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Would you agree? What are we looking at here? What should we expect?
So in response to Trump's announcement, so first of all, the Palestinian people declared 3 days of rage, shutting down schools and businesses and staging massive demonstrations at Damascus Gate, which is one of the entrances of Jerusalem's old city, and cities across Gaza and West Bank. So Hamas also called for the third Intifada, which is an uprising against apartheid Israel. In Palestine, Israeli special forces have used tear gas, rubber bullets, stun grenades, and water cannons to brutally crack down on thousands of Palestinian protesters. And hundreds of these protesters have been reported to be wounded. Many are imprisoned, and some have been killed by Israeli forces. In fact, children of internationally known Palestinian activist Iyad Bernat from Bilyin, who's actually also a friend of Answer Coalition, have been kidnapped by Israeli forces in recent days. It seems to be the case that the strength of the Israeli state repression has forced resistance within Palestine to dampen over the days, unlike what was seen in the past intifadas. But the Palestinian struggle continues to be upheld on the international stage. I think international pressure will play a significant role in the outcome for Palestine, because in recent days across the world, protests erupted outside U.S. embassies and anti-Trump rallies broke out in support of Palestinians in Lebanon, Jordan, Morocco, Egypt, Indonesia, Malaysia, Afghanistan, Turkey are just some of these countries where people took to the streets to stand with Palestine. And demonstrations were also held in major cities across the U.S., from L.A. to New York City. And here in New Mexico, the Answer Coalition participated in an action organized by SJP, and protesters drew the connection between the native struggle here in the U.S. and Palestine. So Muslims across the world are standing in solidarity with Palestine. They oppose the Israeli apartheid state, but many also have burned the U.S. flag and burned effigies of Trump, which is a clear show of opposition to U.S. imperialism that has destroyed the Middle East and other Muslim-majority countries with the excuse of war on terror. So people are not cowering, but are standing up to U.S. hegemony. These demonstrations also represent a fight back against the rampant Islamophobia in the West that is used as a weapon by imperialist politicians to justify their wars and interventions. So the crimes of the U.S. government are being condemned across the world. And we're also seeing a whole new generation, a younger generation of activists taking the lead. We must also keep in mind that the BDS movement, which is boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israeli apartheid, continues to grow despite anti-BDS laws in the U.S., which actually enjoy bipartisan support. So in October of this year, some 16 million members of the All India Kisan Sabha, that's AIKS, that's composed of Indian peasants and farmers, they joined the BDS movement. So given the world situation, I think it's safe to say that the movement will only continue to grow and has immense international support, in contrast to the cowardice and despicable morality of U.S. politicians. I think ordinary working class people and oppressed people across the world are continuing to stand in solidarity with Palestinians for justice and against the Zionist Israeli project of apartheid.
John, I think the point that Satya is making, or one of the points, is extremely important. And that is the relationship of forces on the ground in West Bank, in Gaza, in Jerusalem, in all of Palestine, for instance, may be such that the ability of the Palestinians to have a third intifada at the moment may not be there. We don't know, of course. We don't have a crystal ball. But that relationship of forces has been severely sort of transformed in the past 30 years. The first intifada, by the way, was December 8th, 1987. So Trump's announcement with Pence was almost exactly 30 years later.
Right.
So the relationship of forces during those 30-year period, that three-decade, that's shifted. It's altered. It's worse now for the Palestinians.
It is.
But the point that Satya is making is that globally, Israel has become additionally isolated. Globally, there has been a sea change in political understanding. And even in the United States, which was the bastion 30 years ago for almost a complete full-throated, 100% blank check support for Israel, not just at the governmental level, not just at the media level, but throughout society. That's changing. And ultimately, Trump and Pence and Israel, they may crow about this decision. They may sort of thump their chests and triumphantly say, see, we can do it. But ultimately, it may, in fact, be their undermining.
Oh, I think it actually will. You know, Brian, I think that this decision is such an important one, not relative to the embassy and the location of the embassy itself. It's important in that it significantly weakens the United States in the region. It's as though our enemies somehow made this decision for us. We like to think here in the United States that we are the honest brokers, that we are the only ones that can bring the two sides together. We're the only ones that can bring peace to the region. And that is just simply not true. What is true is we've always come down on the side of the Israelis at the cost of the Palestinians, and we've made our real intentions clear in this action. But as a result of doing so, we are no longer able to be seen as the honest brokers. Now, the sides, if they want peace, I mean, the Palestinians obviously do. I don't necessarily think the Israelis do. But if anybody is going to be able to bring peace, it's going to be someone other than the United States. It's going to be the Russians or the United Nations or the European Union. This significantly weakens us as a player in the region.
Satya, I want to ask you about that as well, because the point that John's making, whether the U.S. is an honest broker or not, it's assumed the pose of the guarantor for any negotiations, the international indispensable voice. But by doing what Trump did, it's sort of the kiss of death of that sort of myth, that fantasy that the U.S. is overseeing negotiations towards a two-state solution. And that will, in fact, create a vacuum that other international players will step into. It seems to be, again, the United States, even from the point of view of empire, shooting itself in the foot. Go ahead.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, on the one hand, the U.S. continues to sell weapons and give $8 billion in aid to Israel every year that is used to seize and occupy Palestinian lands and displace and repress the indigenous Palestinian population. And then on the other hand, it claims, as Nikki Haley has recently said, that the U.S. has more credibility to be the leader of the peace process between Israel and Palestine than the other 14 members of the U.N. Security Council. It's just pure hypocrisy. Because given all this, we know that Trump's announcement being a step towards trying to broker peace between Israel and Palestine, as it's being made out in the corporate media, is an absolute lie. It actually pushes the region into more violence and would actually help speed up the process of Israel occupying more Palestinian land and driving out the indigenous Palestinians from their homes. I mean, how can a settler colonial state like the United States be of any use to an oppressed people fighting to free themselves of settler colonialism? It's absurd. The United States is not impartial. It firmly stands with the racist Israeli state, and its actions have made it clear. Moreover, everywhere and anytime the U.S. has intervened in the internal affairs of nations, it has brought nothing but death and destruction and suffering to the indigenous peoples, because imperialism really has no concern for the rights and well-being of the oppressed and the working class. I mean, the U.S. has shown that it has no respect for the self-determination of Palestinians. And also, Trump's announcement is actually just the U.S. trying to throw its weight around. In the age where its influence is actually declining. So Trump's announcement can be viewed as an attempt to bolster the position of the U.S. and to prove that it still has hegemony over the nations of the world. I mean, the U.S. lost in Syria. It could not overthrow the Syrian government as it wanted to. Now ISIS and Al-Qaeda formations that were supported by the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia have been defeated in Syria, with nations like Syria, Russia, Venezuela, Bolivia, North Korea, or DPRK standing up to U.S. hegemony, and China also becoming a significant influence in world politics, as well as taking on the role as the preferred trading and diplomatic partner for many nations in the world that were previously forced to deal with the United States. The U.S. is really just scrambling here.
That's about all the time we have, but I will add one thing, Brian. Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is in Europe trying to convince EU foreign ministers to follow Trump's lead and to move their embassies to Jerusalem. He's been met with blunt denunciations and refusals, and the EU foreign minister said it's just not going to happen. We'll be right back after this message. Please stay tuned to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Two new polls released this morning show Alabama Democratic Senate nominee Doug Jones and Republican nominee Roy Moore exchanging leads before tomorrow's special election. Will Jones pull off a win in the heavily Republican state, or will Moore extend his extremist influence all the way to Washington? We're joined from Detroit by Julie Hurwitz. She is a partner in the law firm of Goodman & Hurwitz, PC, and was a Bernie Sanders delegate to the DNC Rules Committee. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Julie, we're looking at these polls on realclearpolitics.com, and Fox News, of all outlets, says that Democrat Jones will win by 10 percentage points, 50 to 40. But
they're trying to generate voter turnout for Moore.
They must be, because Emerson says that Moore will win by 9 percentage points, 53 to 44. Besides turnout, do you have any idea what is going on in this race?
Well, I think it's a reflection of what's going on in this country. And that is that everything is up for grabs, and that the Republican Party seems fully entitled and empowered to say and do whatever it wants and endorse whoever they want. And at the same time, take the moral high road, supposedly, quotes, when it comes to anybody on the Democratic side of the political spectrum, even being accused of stuff not even remotely as serious as the things that the accusers of Donald Trump and Roy Moore have alleged against them. So that's what I think is going on. I think that it's a power grab.
I think that's probably right. Brian, just yesterday, President Trump recorded a robocall for Roy Moore. And today, Barack Obama and Joe Biden recorded robocalls for Doug Jones. I think really it does come down to turnout. And for the Democrats, it comes down to turnout in the African-American community. That's where the race will be won or lost.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. And it's hard to get excited about Doug Jones. I mean, yes, he's not Roy Moore, but is that it? I mean, right. That's the pitch. I mean, that was Hillary Clinton's pitch, was I'm not Donald Trump. And guess what? A lot of people didn't show up.
Yeah, I have to say, I've never even heard, speaking from Detroit, I've never even heard Jones open his mouth. I've never heard anything he's ever said other than what the Republicans are saying about him.
Well, that's true. You know, his commercials really are just clips of Republicans saying that they hate Roy Moore.
Yeah. I'm not Roy Moore.
Yeah, we really don't know what Doug Jones stands for.
You know, I have to say, again, sitting from my vantage point, there was just a story released today in the Detroit Free Press about the climate we currently live in and how it's reflecting in the state of Michigan. And this has to do with the Moore Jones race, because what just was released was that since Trump has been elected, there have been massive spikes in reported hate crimes. And the state of Michigan has spiked 29% since January and now has the fourth highest national rate of hate crimes being reported. And it all is, I believe, being motivated and sort of spurred on by this assumption that all bets are off. We can say and do whatever we want. We can say our man is in the White House. We can hate who we want. We can go after with violence who we want. And we can molest little children if we want and get away with it. And so I think this is even in the, progressive quote, wing of the Democratic Party, these connections are clearly being made. You can't avoid them. You have to be deaf, dumb, and blind not to see what's going on in this country.
Roy Moore, in a radio interview a couple of years ago, called for the elimination of all constitutional amendments after the 10th Amendment. Quote, "That would eliminate many problems," Moore said. "You know, people don't understand how some of these amendments have completely tried to wreck the form of government that our forefathers intended." Of course, that would include this, the enslavement of African people. Moore criticized the 17th Amendment, which calls for the direct election of senators by voters rather than state legislators, and the 14th Amendment, which was passed during Reconstruction period following the Civil War and guaranteed citizenship and equal rights and protections to former slaves. Roy Moore wants to get rid of that. I mean, this is who Roy Moore really actually is. I mean, it's not like incidental. It's not late coming demagoguery. This is who that person is.
And, you know, Roy Moore's pastor had an explanation for these accusations against him, whereby he has allegedly assaulted young girls, juveniles. And that was that he was attracted to their purity. Because he's a good Christian.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's the biblical patriarchy thing where this is actually encouraged, you know, this pedophilia for young girls by older men. I mean, that's it really, he does come from this strain of so-called Christianity. Julie Hurwitz, let's go back to the amendment issue. He wants to get rid of the 13th Amendment that abolished slavery. The 15th Amendment, which prohibited the federal and state governments from denying citizens the right to vote. And the 19th Amendment, which would include a suffrage to women. And here you have the president of the United States campaigning for more. And I have to say, this does not make us fans of Doug Jones by any stretch of the imagination. And if you can't beat Roy Moore, that shows what, you know, how empty you are as a candidate and the fact that you stand for nothing. Anyway, we have a situation. I agree with Julie, John, that the not all Trump voters are right wing white supremacists.
No,
but there
I agree.
Is, but there not by any means. But there is a core of the Trump base which is feeling very emboldened, and that core, I believe, really is white supremacist, openly not waiting for dog whistles. Openly misogynist, openly hating immigrants, openly hating Muslims. It has the feel of a semi-fascist current within American society. And again, I'm saying this not about all people who voted for Trump. Many people voted for Trump because they were sick and tired of the establishment. But this is a thing, actually, because of the way Trump has conducted himself.
Oh, I think you're exactly right. When a man just a few days ago felt free enough to throw bacon at a mosque, for example, and then defend himself by saying it was freedom of speech, you know we have a problem in this country.
Yeah, and Roy Moore, Julie Hurwitz, insisted that Keith Ellison, who's African-American and a Muslim, not be able to take the oath of office by putting his hand on a Quran instead of a Bible, because he said a United States is a Christian country.
Well, I think we have quite a bit to be concerned about. And don't get me wrong, I completely agree with you. I'm not suggesting that the majority of people who voted for Trump are fascists, but I am suggesting that there is a strong enough undercurrent of hate and extremist views that are on the far right wing of the spectrum that are using the Trump presidency as a symbol of their legitimacy.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're right, Julie, that a lot of people voted for Trump because they want to change. They were disillusioned with Hillary Clinton or the Democrats, or because even they had been Bernie Sanders supporters and they wanted something different.
There's an overly simplistic view of politics in this country, unfortunately.
But the point that you're making, I think, is so important. This strain of white supremacy and a semi-fascism or fascism, that existed long before Donald Trump. It's just that Donald Trump has become a catalyst in some ways for its reemergence as a political force in America. Am I right? Is that what you're saying?
I am saying that, and a consolidation. You know, German fascism did not arise from a majority of the German population.
That's right.
So let's not forget our lessons of history here. And, the simple fact that someone like Moore can publicly advocate the repeal of the most fundamental individual rights that have now been recognized in our Constitution is extremely disconcerting. And people should be very afraid, because it sounds outrageous to us, but who knows where this is going to lead if this man does end up taking a seat in the Senate. He is clearly someone. I heard an interview this morning, by the way, of an Alabama Republican who said, I will absolutely not vote for Moore because he disregards the rule of law. I'm a lawyer, and I do. And the fact that my discomfort with him started when he was disregarding the court orders about what he was required to do when he was on the Supreme Court of Alabama. And it's mind-blowing to me that he is now this close to becoming a U.S. senator when the Democratic Party has seen fit to sacrifice two of the most progressive voices in Congress in taking the moral high road on this issue of sexual harassment and sexual molestation.
Well, tomorrow we get our answer. Tomorrow is this special election. And whoever wins may not be senator for long, but at least we see which direction the country's going. That was the voice of Julie Hurwitz. She joined us from Detroit. Julie is a partner at the law firm of Goodman and Hurwitz and was a Bernie Sanders delegate to the DNC Rules Committee last year. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has asked his country's Congress to extend martial law in the southern state of Mindanao for a year in order to allow for what he calls the total eradication of Muslim extremists and communists. A key tenet of the request is that all media would be banned from Mindanao. We're joined from San Jose by Adrian Bonifacio. He's the national chairperson of Anakbayan USA. Welcome, Adrian.
Thanks for having me.
Adrian, what is new about this martial law extension that is not already in place with the current martial law situation in Mindanao? Can you explain to our listeners?
So the martial law extension, it was originally declared earlier in the summer, and it was since then extended. It was only supposed to last for a short period. It was extended to the end of the year. And so with this new declaration, it's going to be Duterte is asking for martial law to be extended through next year. And we really see this as a precedent to maybe perhaps even a nationwide martial law, because we know that under martial law in Mindanao, there have been countless cases of human rights violations. There are over 1,000 people dead. There are over 400,000 people who have been displaced, forcibly displaced, because of the aerial bombing that has been going on. People have been dying at the evacuation centers. And so we see this as, why would the administration continue something that has caused so much destruction in Mindanao, if not to kind of consolidate power and silence the opposition to people who are fighting against this military rule in Mindanao?
And indeed, without the media there, it seems as though the government would expect to be able to get away with just about anything.
Exactly. And we know that the Philippines is one of the least safe places for media people. With the recent spate of killings of human rights defenders, of community organizers, it really harkens back to the days of previous presidents, including Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, under which there was a huge media massacre in Ampatuan. And so this is something that we really have to be careful of, because the Duterte administration is currently targeting, of course, people know about his war on drugs, which has killed, you know, over 13,000 people. But now the administration is even targeting the human rights defenders who are trying to call out the senseless violence that the administration is espousing on the people.
It's, Adrian, a remarkable turn of events. When Duterte first came in, he appeared to be a maverick. Nobody knew quite what to make of him. He initiated or said he was open to peace talks with the National Democratic Front, possibly promising the end of the armed conflict is by way of according political rights to those who were involved in the armed struggle that began in the late 1960s. He also changed Philippines, or seemed to be changing Philippines' orientation towards the United States, in the sense that he was reaching out to China, reaching out to Russia, not going along with the court decision at The Hague that his predecessor had initiated with U.S. backing to claim sovereignty over disputed islands in the South China Seas. And then this sudden abrupt turn, or maybe not so abrupt, where he's shifted back into what appears to be a very, for America, a very traditionally happy relationship, even though he's killing thousands of people. He's canceled any sort of negotiations with the NDF. He's declaring martial law, as Marcos did, maybe not yet on the same level. How do you account for this trajectory on the part of the Duterte government?
Well, we've always known that Duterte has been, when he was mayor in Davao, he was close with the left. But we know that he's also been close with the right. I mean, he comes from a political dynasty. And, you know, in the presidency early on, we saw him courting the police, the military. Well, at the same time, he was trying to pursue peace negotiations. And so we see it kind of as, you know, Duterte is a politician, and he is definitely trying to side with those who he thinks he can gain the most power from. And so what we saw with the most recent visit of President Trump to the Philippines for the ASEAN summit is that now Duterte is receiving a lot of support from the U.S., whereas maybe in the previous Obama administration, even though the military aid was still flowing to the Philippines, Obama was more vocal about the human rights situation there. And now that there is explicit support from the U.S., you know, Trump kind of gave Duterte a pat on the back, promised more military aid, more trainings. We see that Duterte has really been emboldened to take more action against not just people who he claims are you know, destabilizing the political order, but he's kind of expanded that to legal activists, to community organizers, to human rights defenders, in addition to the people who are waging an armed struggle in the Philippines, as you mentioned, starting since the late 60s. And so we can see that Duterte is really trying to consolidate political power, and he's doing that with a very iron fist method.
Adrian, we're not hearing a lot of complaints from the likes of Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch. Do you think that Washington's support for Duterte has served to either silence some of these organizations or to push the issue of human rights in the Philippines for them to the back burner?
Well, what's interesting is that, I mean, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, they were vocal about the, you know, some of the drug killings that were going on under Duterte. What they're a little more silent on is the killings of the activists that have been going on. There has been a huge increase in state fascism just within the last 2 weeks alone. In the period of, I believe, December 3rd to 5th, there were 10 political killings. And then under the Duterte regime itself, there have been over 100 extrajudicial killings, and this is not including the drug war, mind you, but over 100 political killings, over 80 victims of torture, over 400,000 forced evacuations. And so these are all human rights violations, human rights abuses that need to be highlighted. And organizations in the Philippines that have been doing human rights work, such as Karapatan, are the ones that are really on the ground and able to expose these human rights violations that are going on. And so those are the kind of organizations that we've been looking to get the latest updates and the latest news.
What do you think is the next step for those human rights groups, especially in light of the fact that Duterte really is quite politically powerful, and so few people have had the wherewithal to act against him?
Right. And so, I mean, in the face of repression, the only option is resistance. And so a lot of these killings have been of organizations that are trying to change the status quo, whether they be fisher folk organizations, whether they be farmer or peasant organizations, youth organizations that are saying no to the status quo. You know, when Duterte came into power, he said all these grand proclamations about kicking the U.S. out, about not having foreign intervention. But what do we see now? We see that a neoliberal economic policy continues to be pushed. The rehabilitation of Marawi, one of the cities that was completely destroyed by martial law in Mindanao, it's going to be the Asian Development Bank and the World Bank that are restructuring it. And so we see the influx of this kind of foreign capital that is not going to benefit the Filipino people. We see the invitation of U.S. military. U.S. military exercises have not ended. U.S. troops are still in the Philippines. And so there are all these groups that are fighting against this status quo. And even though the Duterte regime is targeting them with U.S. support, the only option is really for human rights defenders, for community organizations to fight back. And for us here in the United States, that includes, raising awareness of what's happening, increasing solidarity for what's happening in the Philippines. This past weekend, actually, the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines, which Anak Bayan USA is a member of, launched a United States chapter. And so there are more and more people who are caring about the human rights situation in the Philippines, and we need to do our best to support the people on the ground that are actively fighting the fascism in the country.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We're out of time. We've been joined from San Jose, California by Adrian Bonifacio. He is the national chairperson of Anak Bayan USA. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. If you're in the Washington, D.C. area, you can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, at 105.5 FM and 1390 AM between 4 and 6 p.m. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.